Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here for our next in a set of season reviews. Tonight, we're talking the interior offensive line, and my friend Michael Crawford, one of my mostest, favoritest people to talk football with, is here. Michael, how you doing?
I'm doing well, Ken. It's always so generous of you to say that. I appreciate you having me on, and wish we were talking a few weeks later after the Super Bowl, particularly a Ravens win in the Super Bowl, but not reality, not where we're at. So here we are. Still always good to talk ball. Always enjoy that time with you. So wish it was under different circumstances, but you know, they are what they are.
The cheapest ticket for the Super Bowl right now is about $4,900 before fees on SeatGeek. So it was going to be an expensive game to go to, but I'm not sour grapesing it. I'd much rather be there and undergoing the expense rather than here talking this. Let's talk about the Ravens' interior offensive line. We'll discuss the offensive tackles on another show, but the overall offensive line had an outstanding continuity score. It was published by Aaron Schatz. I don't know if he's the one who actually was the originator of it, but he was able to tell me about the formula. It's a 51-point scale, which might not seem like a natural scale to use, but there's a maximum of 17 you can get in each of three categories. The first is, How many 22 minus the number of starters you had during the year. So the most points you can get is 17, obviously, because you need to have five starters at a minimum. But some teams had 11 or 13 starters, and those teams obviously didn't score as well. The second was the number of consecutive games you played together at the max. So in theory, you could play 17 in a row together. The Ravens' longest streak, I think, was 13 or something. It might have been slightly less than that from weeks. The starter in week 18 was actually McCarrie's. I don't know if that was counted or not, but I think it's like weeks 4 to 17 or 4 to 16, which would have been 13 weeks. They got a score for that. And then the third one is, let me see if I can remember what this one was. Had to do with number of changes. I'm trying to remember exactly. But anyway, it's not important. Anyway, out of the maximum of a 51 for score for continuity, the Ravens got 46. For continuity. Good. So they were the most continuous line in the National Football League. And it's actually a fairly substantial margin between them and the next best. No, no response to that. That's fine.
I was thinking about who the next, you know, because you kept hearing so much about the Bills O-line and how much they had played together. Just that right. Part of it, just that one element of the score. Of
you're right. They were talking about how many snaps they played together in particular. Let me see if I can bring this up.
But I didn't say anything because I was like, well, based on the scores you just gave me, I guess it wasn't the Bills.
You are that is quite all right. I will work towards getting that additional column for us that'll have the second most line. I think about the interior offensive line. I mean, one of the things I think about Ravens units in the past, particularly during the Roman era, was a tremendous number of pulls. This is a much less pull-intensive scheme than they had with more athletic guards. So when it was Zeitler or even Bozeman, who I don't really consider to be a tremendous athlete, it was more than it's been with Fa'alele in particular, but also even McCarrie is pulling a lot less than Ravens left guards of the past.
Yeah, I mean, there's usually more than one reason for most things in life. this probably holds true for this too, but you got to think the concepts that Derrick Henry is the most comfortable running, primarily, you know, a really heavy zone concept runner with Tennessee, probably factored into that to some degree. Could it also be the skill set of this particular group of O-linemen? That could also be a factor, but I definitely think, and it makes sense, right? If you have a player of Derrick Henry's caliber, you're going to try to cater to what he's most comfortable with and what he does well as much as you can.
Yeah, and certainly been a good zone runner. I think you could probably put him in almost any scheme, but he's certainly done very well with that. The Ravens' run game hasn't really suffered at all over the past couple of years, despite the absence of Greg Roman. They rush for 5.2 yards per carry now in the Jackson era, and the next highest is 4.6 for six other teams. So that is an enormous chasm-like difference. And they published some stats on success rates and running backs with and without Lamar Jackson, but I think it's fair to say that it's Lamar Jackson who deserves a commission on all rushing yards and not the running back who should get some higher level bonus for reaching certain yardage totals. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. And I think Derrick Henry even, you know, sort of alluded to that at various times throughout the season about how much easier it made his job playing with Lamar, because as we know, going back to 2019, you know, first season where Lamar becomes a full-time starter, so much of the defensive reaction is focused on him on every play, on every snap. So, you know, even when you have a great runner like Derrick Henry, and let's not make any mistake about it, he's a great runner. It's going to benefit him as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been a great pairing. Honestly, I was very lukewarm spending all these dollars on Derrick Henry, given, you know, other teams' needs in terms of salary, and in particular all the extensions that are coming up this offseason, which the Ravens are due for some very tough choices coming up right now. But he's been totally worth the money, and then some. And he'll be worth the money next year, I hope. Certainly if he stays healthy, he will. So it's great to see that. And the commitment that he has to his offseason workout is like no one else I've ever heard of in terms of what he does. And he certainly looks the part physically when he gets on a playing field, and when he's lifting weights, he doesn't look like any other running back I've ever seen. But anyway, impressive human being, certainly. Justice Hill, also a fine year. We're not here to talk about the running backs, but they made it work too in the system. And those guys basically had every single carry for the seasons this year. Mitchell had a few, about 11 carries or something in one game. Otherwise it was really all Hill and Henry.
Really productive season too for Justice. I'm glad you mentioned his name. I mean, just reliable, dependable. You know, you're going to have some plays that people point to here and there, particularly in pass pro, even though I think overall he was solid in pass pro, but you know, it's the NFL. So, you know, you're not going to win every situation, but, I remember when they signed him, was it a year or two ago? And there was a little bit of, you know, some angst. I think, well, spending much money on a backup running back. I mean, it seems like it's been a pretty sound investment to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's been totally worth the money, and also been a guy that's helped him a lot on special teams, and just a very, very fine complimentary player. How about the Ravens' ability to run when the other team knows it's coming? Now, this is something the Ravens have not lost a two-score game in 3 years with Lamar Jackson now. It's since that Miami game where they got 40s cover zero blitzes in the game. That's the last time they lost by two scores. In this year, they weren't ever in a position where the other team was really running the clock out of them. Or if they were, it wasn't for very much time. But the Ravens were certainly in a position where they were closing out some games. I was very impressed with the way they were still able to run it effectively in those situations.
It's the hallmark of a dominant run game when everybody in the stadium, everybody watching at home knows what's coming and they can't do anything to stop it. It's got to be such a demoralizing thing too if you're on defense, because you know it, and you know you're sending in personnel, you know you're running schemes specifically to try to stop it in those situations. You're like, we got to stop them and get the ball back. And you just can't. There's just nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk some individual players here. We'll start with Tyler Lindebaum, the center. I've got some things to say about his pass blocking this year. He took a pretty significant step backwards as a pass blocker from 2023. Still remains very effective at a number of things. He's a great mobility blocker, great guy for getting into level two, good leader of the line, I think, in general. I think he's picked up on all that's necessary. What are your high-level thoughts on him?
Yeah, I mean, I think still probably among the better centers in the league, right, at that position. I was reading your notes that you sent before the show, so I know that you're going to get into some specifics about his pass protection this year. You know, and we'll probably talk about this as well as we go, but, you know, having two new guards on either side of you has got to factor in. On some level, not to completely absolve him of any individual accountability, He certainly wouldn't do that, right? If we were talking to him, he would put it all on his own shoulders. But, you know, if we're being realistic, that's got to factor in a little bit to maybe some of that. But yeah, still, you know, his calling card coming out of Iowa was mobility. Still, you know, kind of, you know, what he hangs his hat on, being able to get to level two, being able to do a variety of different things, and, you know, screen game on the line of scrimmage, you know, in terms of his ability to cover space and get to players and cover guys up and stay with them, right? That can be difficult too. For one, you got to get there. Two, you got to stay with this guy in space and not allow him to come off and make a play on the ball. So, you know, still, like I said, I think one of the better centers in the league at his position. But yeah, it had to be a bit of an adjustment for him this year with those two new guys, like, I guess three, if you factor Voorhees and then McCary and then Falele next to him.
He got one big guy in the group last year. He had Zeitler and, you know, a big guy at left guard in Simpson, who, you know, a bigger body, a little bit of length there too. You got to like that. But this year had a tough pass block year. Fell back to the middle of the league, and that's something that he had shot up in 23. Been one of the best blockers, especially when you adjust his performance relative to others. And this year, he's pretty much a league average pass blocker. And I got some other stats today from Timo Riska, who's the PFF head of R&D. And he sent me ones that are opponent adjusted. Now, they don't do opponent adjusted on their site, but he's done some graphs in that. You can look them up. They're out there. But Linderbaum was basically right at league average, and multi-year league average is how Timo puts it for that. And effectively, these numbers adjust for quality of opponent, down and distance, game situation, things like that. Whether basically it's harder to pass block when the other team knows you're trying to pass. Mm-hmm. You know, they can give up on their run responsibilities. He's being a league average one. It would be great if we knew this was happening in 24 and it was just after the 22 season. But it actually represents an element of regression from 23, where he'd really step forward. And I think, if I'm going to say it as nicely as I can, I think in 23, there's no doubt about it, he earned his Pro Bowl. In 24, I don't think he did.
Hmm. Yeah, I hope that, you know, maybe next year he can kind of have a return to that form that you talked about in 2023. You never really know how much, and I'm not trying to make excuses, but it's this time of the year where we hear these things, right? Like after season's over, you'll hear like some guy was playing with something all year long or playing through some type of injury all year long. So I don't know if maybe that's a factor on some level too, but then you also just got to think teams are, with the changes that the Ravens had in the interior, that teams were going to be able to scheme certain kinds of things to isolate guys, to get guys in more, you know, games and twist situations, and, you know, make it more difficult for them to kind of do the things that they're the best at. You know, typically, I remember, you know, Greg Roman allegedly said this, like, it's harder to hide offensive linemen the further you get out from the center. So I can hide the center, essentially, right? But it's harder to do that when you get out to the tackles. And so if you think about it that way, and that your guards can help your center, but then you have these guards who essentially need help themselves from the center, kind of reverses things. And, you know, it's just kind of a domino effect in that way, that it can just make all three of those positions, the jobs for all three of those positions, more challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And Simpson had a big problem with penalties, but not as much of a problem as a pass blocker. In fact, I thought last year he might have had as good a pass blocking year as Zeitler did, but he had a number of penalties, obviously, with the Simpson issue going through this. Getting back to Linderbaum, though, more trouble with stunts and blitzes. Now, that might have also been a function of McCary and Falele specifically, is that when you need to hand people off in a stunt game, that makes it very difficult if your guard doesn't react very quickly, doesn't process at the same rate that you do.
Yeah, for sure. And all it takes is that fractional amount of time to delay, and there's somebody on you, right? Either looping from another direction, or like you said, an off the ball blitzer. Mm-hmm. And when you're, you know, to be kind, an undersized guy at that position to begin with, a lot of your advantage is your athleticism and your mobility. and your ability to kind of dictate the terms, right? To be proactive in how you engage blocks and how you, you know, you start that that process. But when you're reactive to it, and guys are coming at you with heads of steam, and you see them late, quote unquote late, you know, it's delayed, it's going to make it that much more difficult.
Right. So that would be blocked. Like a McCary excuse. Falele is huge, but he has also processing issues that have slowed him down a little bit. I'm generally pretty positive, by the way, on Falele, as we're going to get to it. But with Linderbaum, another thing that I was noticing this year that I really didn't like is the ground he gives up with initial contact for the first time in really a lot of years had an impact on the Ravens pull game. And they had not, they really had not had an issue with this in a very long time. Footwork was excellent during the Skura, Bozeman eras, you know, and you know, so far in the Linderbaum era before 24. But he got backed up a few times. When Falele pulls, he's a very big dude. He also kind of lumbers, so he's not as easy to get out of the way of McCary's feet. Linderbaum's feet, but McCary had some of the same problems going left to right as well. Obviously, more opportunities, but it's something we really hadn't seen in a lot of years in Baltimore is problems with bigger men pushing the center back and compromising pulls.
Yeah, and I wonder if sometimes that's just a function of, hey, just some season, some game, some plays, you just get caught, you know, where a guy's jumping the snap count, he's timing the snap count. And, you know, if particular and maybe even like you said, increased usage of zone concepts, because most of the time, particularly on wide zone or outside zone, defensive linemen are taught what kills that play is penetration.
Yep.
So if you can just get up the field in a direct line, not necessarily going laterally, but almost, you know, perpendicular, almost vertically, and just drive, whether it's the center or any of those interior blockers back, you can really blow up that play. But I think we saw it happen once in the Bills game, right, where he got driven back into Lamar and Lamar trips up. So like you say, it hasn't been something that I obviously don't score it and track it the way that you do, but hasn't felt like an issue we've seen a whole lot in recent years, but does feel like maybe it's popped up a little bit more this year.
So the other year we're looking at now, because we're still trying to catch up back to the beginning of franchise history, we've been doing working on this year for like several years, so you've heard, probably heard me tell the story. The 2005 season is a disastrous one for the interior offensive line of the Baltimore Ravens. And they have three guys playing in there, and they might as well be the Three Stooges. Mike Flynn, who played in the league for a long time, had a lot of trouble with his footwork, and his first instinct was to step backwards, which is not what you want on pulls. And I think this was before Joe D arrived. I'm not sure exactly when he arrived, but when he arrived is basically when I think of a lot of this footwork getting cleaned up.
Well, God rest his soul, but we know, and you probably better than me, because you've been out to practice and training camp, a number of times, how much of a stickler he was for the technical details of offensive line play, particularly footwork, hand placement, those kinds of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you watch offensive line sessions going on, and he's very hands-on. He gets right in there. He shows you exactly where to put your feet when you see somebody not doing it, exactly where he wants him to push your hands, exactly how he wants torque delivered and whatnot. It was great. I'll never probably get over missing him. Even if the Ravens find another great offensive line coach, I'm always going to be comparing the two, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of what's going on, it is very high on the Ravens' priority list to get a good O-line coach.
Oh yeah, probably. You know, and you hear this, other coaches, other people around the game talk about it, but even just as fans, you kind of can see it in terms of how the offensive line performs and what kind of impact that has on the overall team. It's oftentimes here, it's if not the most important non-head coach, you know, coaching role in the building, it's right there. Yeah. You know, the offensive line coach. So, it really is critical to have a good one. And we see it around the league with the teams that do have a good one and the impact that it has on those groups.
Good save by Warhop coming in. Yeah. He's not at an age where he's going to be your next coach for the next 20 years. So I think it ought to be in his job description to anoint the next guy, train him up in the way he'd like it to be done, and have that guy be the younger offensive line coach. So there's a 32-year-old frustrated offensive lineman out there right now, I bet, coaching at some college level, who could be had and be turned into a fine offensive line coach. They just have to identify him. And
yeah, that those options are out there. And then I don't, is Travell Warden still the assistant?
Yeah, he's still with the team.
Oh my God, or something. So, yeah. You know, he, I don't know where he is at in that progression in terms of where he is on his coaching journey. But, you know, I think seems like a guy that they identified, younger guy. I don't remember when he stopped playing, but not been like a terribly, terribly long time ago, I don't think. So, you know, could be a potential in-house candidate somewhere down the road. But to your point, you know, if you can find that guy, if he's out there and you can find him, and by all means, let's try to get him in the building.
11 years ago, he retired in 2020, okay. 23.
Longer than I thought.
Oh, 2013, he retired. Yeah. He still relates well to players. If you just watch him, he's a guy who the players clearly respect, and it's a different conversation between Joe D and his players and Travell Warden and his players. Actually, modestly surprised he didn't get the job when it came open, but they had their plan and. Yeah. You know, if he's not the guy, then, you know, I'm a firm believer in the NFL is a tough place, but you got to get rid of the assistant coaches who aren't really playing a part of your succession plan. Mm-hmm. You can hire interns, but hire them at the end. You know, they're guys who are here. Maybe they work out, maybe they don't. They're a lottery ticket, maybe in some sense, but you take a chance on them. But the guys I want in my succession planning, I want to make sure every single guy who's got a full position coach role is part of my thoughts of either going to be the offensive line coach or going to be either coordinator, one or the other.
Yeah. And that's something I think, you know, for all the things people say about Harbaugh, particularly recently, in light of how the season ended, hiring coaches, hiring a staff, I think is something that he does, you know, pretty well.
Yeah. They're only getting rid of one guy is what I've heard is the inside linebackers coach is on the way out. Yeah. Now that's a unit that really could stand to have some good coaching up, and or probably I think he must have some pretty strong feelings about how that relationship worked out, honestly. So hopefully they'll get the right guy there. Let's talk a little more. Linderbaum here led the league was second in the league among centers with 10 penalties. One of the kind of ones that didn't get charged to him officially, but the delay of Kane Bentley in the AFC divisional game was on him. Mm. He's sitting there still telling linemen, you know, how they need to pick up this blitz situation, as the clock is pretty much hitting zero.
Yeah, that's tough too. And I think that's something that you see defenses do against all teams. I'm not saying they specifically target the Ravens, but you know, obviously when you're game planning for a specific team, if you see that kind of tendency, like, hey, the later in the down, we can do things in terms of movement and to cause them to react. And to try to make checks or, you know, recount or whatever they need to do, that maybe we can force, you know, some of those penalties. Obviously, ultimately, you're trying to just confuse the pass protection and create advantages that way. But you might have the additional benefit of causing a delay again.
Right. And the Ravens do a number of things like that. In particular, they really take advantage when the offensive team substitutes late. They'll substitute even later because they have the right to do so, and they'll try and force a delay of game penalty or at least a rushed snap in that case as well. And they know just how to time their time onto the field, so they get there with like 2 seconds, say, remaining, and then the official standing in the way gets out of the way, quarterback goes down, and delay of game's called. Yeah. In terms of his grades so far for the year, as I scored it, didn't have any single failing grade this year, which is a little bit unusual because most linemen have a really bad game in a year. There's a lot of game-to-game variation. You know, in a 20-game stretch for a baseball player, you'd certainly expect him to probably go 0-for-4 with 3 strikeouts and maybe even make an error in a game. But he didn't have a game like that this year. All his games were D or higher, although there were some lower grades this year. He had trouble with bigger men. I did want to talk a little bit about his raw score here. And what I want to do differently this year is talk about how his deductions, what was the source of his deductions. So the scale I create is a 0 to 1 scale. It actually could be negative because you can get negative points. So it's actually technically positive to get negative. It's happened one time in a game. But for basically, the top score is 1. And it's how much, where did your deductions come from is what I've calculated for each of the linemen this year. So for Linderbaum, missed blocks were 40% of the raw score lost. And that's not, I would say that's not uncommon for a center. It could be a little bit less, but that's about where I would expect his number to be, even if he had a really good year. you know, 85 or something or 88. I'd expect him to be, you know, 0.06 to 0.08 in terms of missed blocks as a total of lost plays. Go through the rest of this. Penetrations, they count as a minus two, but you also get a zero for the play. So it's really kind of like a minus three on the play. He had 0.02 per play in penetrations. Those are times when he causes a loss on a run play. So we're talking about a frequency and severity model. When he makes a run block, it doesn't work out, especially if it's in a level two or something. Honestly, the cost of that missing that block is fairly low relative to, you know, a cost where you lose yardage on the play.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm always amazed at the level of detail that goes into the scoring system that you have. But I think it's cool to kind of shed that light on where the deductions come from. Obviously, you talk about the scoring and you talk about the deductions, but to kind of pull the curtain back even a little bit more and say, hey, here's what caused this deduction. Here's the type of situations that happen and why I assign the value to that particular situation that I assign. I wish all scoring systems would do that, but you know.
Which one are you missing? Because PFF, they'll tell you if you want to know. But well,
you could just publicize it. I don't.
Yeah, you could. They could make it easier for us. You're right. it would be.
Now, I have seen that if you ask them, though, to their credit, you're right. I've seen that when you ask any of their guys, really, especially the ones in the Ravens community, if you ask, they'll explain it to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I really haven't had any problem with that. And they'll talk methodology, too. It's just what they won't do, and it's because of their agreement with the teams, is they won't give you grades by play. Yeah. So I try and do that in my articles. You're seeing all the major deductions. I actually don't list out every missed block. I'll give you a total of missed blocks. And part of that is just there's too many of them to really do that. It's not a matter of I don't want you to know. It's a matter of, you know, it's a little bit too much to put in a one-page article. So
yeah.
Let's keep going with this. So penetrations are 0.02 with a total. So about one-fourth as much of as missed blocks is a way to think of it. Pressures, 0.03. All right. So that... little bit more, but Linderbaum actually didn't have a terrible year for allowing pressures. I think that would be about normal for a center. Where he wasn't good and where PFF would lead you to believe otherwise is in the quarterback hits and sacks. Now, I believe that PFF will have him for zero sacks for this year. I will ask you to remember some specific plays. Okay, yeah. First of all, he snapped the ball off his foot. Lamar had to recover it in the backfield for a four-yard loss. Mm-hmm. I called it a sack. It's not a sack, but it's a sack for scoring purposes because it has a similar effect to a four-yard sack. Fair?
Yeah, fair.
All right. He snapped the ball wide left on Lamar on the sack that happened. There was a sack fumble that happened in the Buffalo game.
Yeah.
Okay. And he had another one that was wide that I didn't go back and look at today, and I meant to. That was either the game before or the game after. It might have been against Tampa Bay or it might have been Cleveland. But it was in one of those two games that were played consecutively. He had another snap that ended up being a sack, and I forget if the play was aborted or what the issue was, but it was definitely a snap issue. So higher than you might expect. You might expect zero sacks and just maybe a quarterback hit or two, that he'd be at 0.01 or something, but he's really at 0.03. It's just as much of the deductions as the pressures were. And then to give you an idea of how serious that is, his penalties are 0.03 also. And he was second in the league in penalties. So it's a not insignificant set of deductions. That pressure number should be the highest. Quarterback hits and sacks and penalties should both be low for a center. The typical center, the median was about 5 penalties this year, and he had 10.
So twice as many. Those snaps, it's when you mention those individual plays, mm-hmm. I'm not saying that he's trending in that direction, but who was the center they had that really had an issue with like high snaps? Like it was happening like once a game for a while, not over the course of a whole season. It might have been like a 3 or 4 game span or something like that, but it was really like an issue, and to the point where they were like discussing it. You know, when you're getting asked about it in press conferences, like it's a real issue. He's not on that level, but just when you mention those plays, it, for whatever reason, it jogged that memory. I can't remember which.
McCary and Bozeman each had problems with it at various times.
Yeah, might have been Bozeman. Might have been.
Yeah. I it's not something I associate with Skura. But the other thing that was very frustrating is Linderbaum's got a very nice fastball of a snap that goes right to the midsection, right to the belt on most snaps. So he's very good in general. But the other guys, and Bradley Bozeman in particular, he had like a 12 to 6 curveball he would snap up there. You know, it's slow looping thing. And that's, I mean, that takes reaction time. Lamar can't read the feed as quickly. So, yeah. Okay. So, C plus overall grade as I scored it for Linderbaum this year. I did see one piece of information from Timo Riska. Now, he sent me these adjusted scores, and Linderbaum is in an enormous cluster of guys right around zero. But there are really only about seven guys in the National Football League, or six guys, who are distinctly better than him as pass blockers relative to their expectation. And part of that was that Linderbaum had the fifth most difficult set of assignments by Timo's scoring. So it's just, it's one other thing. It does use the PFF grades directly. This is an expected PFF grade on the play, an actual PFF grade on the play. It sums up all of those with specific adjustments for various situational components. But I trust that it is a step forward from the basic PFF scoring model. I'll say that in terms of what it does. So I think it does a, you know, pretty good job of looking at the opponent.
Yeah, and particularly if it does, if it's situational too. If you, you know, if you, you're saying that is there are specific blocking situations that it assigns some sort of value to, or at least captures those situations on some level. That's about as granular as you can get, aside from, you know, being in the O-line room and the O-line coach breaking down, you know, your film.
I agree. Big situation coming up for Linderbaum this offseason, because there's a year five option the Ravens will have to decide on if they can't re-sign him, because they would have to pay left tackle money for a center. I think not because they don't like him, they love him. Yeah. I think they will not exercise the year five option. It'd be up there $22 million or something, and that's not happening. But I think they will try and sign him long term, and they'll try and very hard to get that done prior to May. So it doesn't become an issue in terms of him potentially wanting to play out his the final year of his deal here and see what he can get on the open market.
That's my hope, that they reach that extension. You know, obviously, you know, sooner rather than later for the team, more beneficial at least. But yeah, that would be tough. That would be tough on that fifth year option at that number for center. Obviously, they love him, like you said. It's not anything to do with his performance or who he is as a player on or off the field. But, you know, you've got to navigate these financial considerations. And like you have mentioned earlier in this, they've got a number of them. So you got to try to find areas where you can, you know, get some cost cutting, or at least kind of pushing things out into future years wherever you can.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on to Patrick McCary. He started the season at right tackle, alternating series with Rosengarten as they tried to work him in there. Then the team had a need with an injury to Andrew Voorhees to have him move to left guard, and they took it rather than put, say, Ben Cleveland in there. They moved McCary. A lot of people had questions about that at the time. Where were you on it at that time?
I mean, I'm a McCary fan, so I didn't have an issue with it. I just think the thing with Ben Cleveland for me is, like, we never seem to get like a real clear explanation, or at least I didn't have a real clear understanding of maybe why he didn't get as many opportunities or more opportunities than he got. You know, there were comments from Harbaugh about Ben knows what he needs to do, and, you know, those kinds of things. And when he did play in games, I you would know this better than me, but I never came away feeling like, oh, that was a disaster. You can't have that guy out there. So it's just weird. I mean, you heard rumblings about maybe he's not the most, you know, dedicated practice player, but all of that stuff is like, you know, scuttlebutt stuff. This is nothing, you know, definitive that I know for sure. So it wasn't that I was against the move per se, but I've always just kind of wondered, like, what did this guy do to not be given more opportunities? It just made sense to me.
I've had the same question, because the tip of the iceberg that we can see, his play has been good enough to earn the right to fail. Yeah. You know, and you don't have to play great to earn the right to fail, but if you play at a C level, you know, at that position, you've earned the right to have a chance there and potentially good. I think he actually played probably a little bit above that. There's one event where that question might be answered. Okay. And I'll tell you, I'll tell the audience here, because if we've got anyone going to the State of the Ravens event, please send me a DM on Twitter. I'll tell you exactly the question to ask. But basically, it's this, is like, now that Cleveland has signed blah, 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 wherever that is, because like the event is in May and Cleveland will probably be, probably be signed by then. Can you tell us what issues there were other than his play at left guard that kept him from getting a chance? So you want to be as quick as terse as you can with the question, so he doesn't start answering questions about why the sky is green and whatnot. Just to try and get him directly pinned down on that specific question. Make the question short. They also appreciate that, because this event, I'm telling you, everybody wants to ask a CEO question where they summarize the last 5 years of offensive line play before they get to their, you know, question that wasn't any good to start with. Mm-hmm. So you give them a good, quick question like that, they'll really appreciate it. Can you tell me specifically what it was that, and he might answer it there once Cleveland is not a Raven. He'll never answer it publicly.
Right.
He will never. We wish him the best. You know, we hope in his next job. I mean, that's just part of just being a good corporate HR person. That the Ravens, you know, have been exceptionally good with.
Yeah, no advantage to him bad-mouthing the guy publicly, right? That doesn't help them in any way.
Yeah, absolutely. And McCary, when he came in, had a lot of penalty problems at first at guard. In fact, he was tied, I think, for the league leading penalties at guard with 14. Might have been somebody had 15, but it was really tight in there. He was in there, and one of his penalties occurred at offensive tackle, so it was like 13 at guard. But here's the good news. He did really have a solid season as a blocker, and we're going to get into some of that in terms of the source of deductions. But he had a lot of penalties for his first 9 games at guard, but in his last 7, just had 1 false start. Yeah. So if you're a believer that penalties can be fixed, then McCary is your poster child.
That is interesting. I did not realize that it got cleaned up that much over those last 7 games. But do you know how many false starts he had before those last 7?
False starts weren't the problem. It was a bunch of offensive holdings.
Okay.
You don't want the post-snap fouls are totally unacceptable. He might have had 1 illegally downfield. I'll look it up while you're.
Yeah, I remember that one. Pittsburgh. He did have 1 because he called back up. I think it was a Derrick Henry catch and run or something like that. And yeah, he did get called for that.
That had to be in the first Pittsburgh game. Yeah, his last 7 included the playoffs. So, yeah, I'm sure that was it.
Yeah, it was the first Pittsburgh game. But, okay, well, still good. Still good that, you know, that only penalty over those last 7 games was a false start. So, yeah, I guess there's something there, right, when you hear – because obviously Harbaugh was getting asked about it week after week after week as pressers, and say, hey, you know, we're working on it. You know, we're working on it. We're trying to fix those things. Guys are trying to clean those things up. And I guess there's a poster child for it, right? McCary, he cleaned it up.
Yeah, here are the penalties for the year. So he only had 1 false start according to the NFL's official statistics. So I think one of the false starts was on McCary clearly by the video. So I gave that to him, and I have to get the week for you, but it's his late penalty that occurred after week 12. Here's the rest of them. Illegal formation, declinable. Offensive holding, offensive holding, offensive holding, offensive holding, offensive holding, all declinable. Illegal downfield pass, that was in week 10 against Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. Unsportsmanlike conduct, illegal downfield pass, and offensive holding, all in that game against Pittsburgh. Decline, it nullified 34 yards of gains on those 2 illegal downfield pass, and the holding penalty stalled a drive. So that and the first one of the 2 stalled a drive as well, the first of the illegal 2 downfield passes. So you can't do much worse than that. And then he had 1 more final offensive holding in week 12 to finish up his season. That is a prodigiously bad season for penalties. But what's incredible to me is as that was happening, he was having a pretty good blocking year and is still playing at about a C level, even with this monstrous set of penalties. Mm.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes holding, I'm not justifying it. Obviously, it's not something you want. But sometimes, you know, at least for me, if the penalty is of an effort kind of nature, like you're trying, mm-hmm. right? You're trying to make a play and you get flagged. It's case by case on those, right? If it's the other stuff, like the illegal downfield, like, okay, you got to know where you are on the field. I mean, that's something that they practice. It's definitely something they go over. You can't make those kinds of mistakes. That's not effort based per se. that's just kind of having that awareness of knowing where you are on the field and making sure that you don't, you know, get back. Was it 1 yard in the NFL, something like that? Don't get downfield past that restriction. But the volume of holdings, right, going back to what I was just saying about effort and how maybe sometimes that justifies it, that's just too many. it's too many.
And knowing when to give up on the edge of run plays is almost always what that comes down to. Mm. And I wish somebody could teach a class that would really stick with NFL players about the relative value of their block on such a run play and the relative cost of a holding flag that would get them to stop this once. It'd be like a scared straight math class. I wish they would could somehow express just how costly that is relative. But you know, talk to some people and they don't even really understand the difference between a declinable foul and a pre-snap foul. Like false start is not nearly as bad as an illegal downfield penalty. They're both 5 yards, but it's, you know, the declinable component of that is enormous.
Yeah. And you would hope that these things are being discussed.
I would, right? Hope.
I mean, you've got all, I mean, look, obviously you've got the O-line coach, who's the offensive line coach, or just the position coach in each of these rooms, who's responsible for a lot of different things. But typically they've got a number of like assistants in there or interns, you know, so you got people, yep, who can go off and kind of do these, you know, little specific projects. And we saw through Hard Knocks, right? Some of these people like Daniel Stern, some of these doing presentations.
He'd be the guy. Yep.
What's his name? Noel Riley, you know, was another one of the guys. So you see these guys doing these like specific presentations. So got to think it's something that they would be discussing and trying to make the players aware of.
It did improve across the OL. So we'll get to some other players there who did that. You know, interestingly enough, and this is why McCary doesn't rate particularly higher on the list of all guards in the league. I think he's like 35th out of 57 guards in his overall play. I would not ever look at that overall number from PFF. You want to look at the separate pass and run blocking numbers. Their way of weighting those two doesn't make any sense. They way overweight run blocking for interior offensive linemen, and they way underweight penalties. So those two things actually go in opposite directions for McCary, but it's one of the problems. But if you look at pass blocking alone, he was 19th of 57 guards in pass blocking score, and I've got similar pass blocking numbers we'll get to in a minute that are you know reasonably good for a guard. But Timo's the numbers Timo sent me for guard for his opportunity set was the. Make sure I get this right. I got to get the guard one here. I got the center. Yeah. So Patrick McCary's had the third toughest set of assignments in the entire NFL. And it's a pretty broad distance in terms of expected grade between about minus 0.05 and minus 0.08 per play he'd be expected to get by PFF. Daniel Falele was in the top 8 or 9. As well. So it's a, you know, the Ravens guards and centers, they placed some challenging interior lines. And you think about the division they play in, yeah, you certainly would have some of that. And they, you know, they played the Eagles as well. And some very scary teams in terms of the interior.
Yeah. And I think McCary, even going back to other years where he maybe played a little bit more at tackle, I think for me, a strength of his game was always pass blocking, more so than run blocking to me. And I used to talk with Chris Aguilera about this all the time, how he doesn't have the body type or the physical dimensions of kind of like prototypical tackle, but he has the ability in pass protection to kind of mirror and stay in front of guys, use his hands proactively, re-leverage and refit his hands when he maybe doesn't win that initial. He does a lot of things that a good pass blocking tackle is able to do. He doesn't have that body or those physical dimensions. So this is kind of a weird thing that he has that skill set in more of a guard's body or a center, really, probably more than anything else, like a center's body. But, you know, it's good to hear that it sounds like that translated to some of these scores.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting to see that. Yeah, the chance of him coming back, we can save this for the end, but I guess we'll talk about it right now. It seems to be pretty low. The Ravens have an awful lot of hands out for cap dollars. McCary on a multi-year deal is not going to be cheap. At least I don't think he is. I think the Ravens probably, what do you think, give him an offer to take to the market and he should do considerably better?
Yeah, probably. I would imagine that's what they would want to do. Another guy who, you know, you imagine they'd love to keep, but they've been in these situations a number of different times over the years with a number of different guys where guys just kind of price themselves out of what they want to pay. They make them an offer, but allow the guy to go and test the market. And if you can find a better deal, then, you know, good for you. You should.
Yeah. I hope that's what they do. I would love to have him back, but the amount that I'm willing to pay for the versatility there is probably less than he deserves. And honestly, if he's a guy playing guard who you also have value because you know he can step in at tackle if you need him, and I think that's what he is, you might end up paying today's NFL. I'm thinking $8 million a year for that guy, $8 million of AAV.
Probably. I mean, they got ahead of it, right? The first time they extended him. But now the kind of secret's out now. So,
right. Yeah, they did do a good job on that. So, all right. Voorhees may be ready. Another big leap for the line to overcome if it's Voorhees replacing McCary. Let's talk aggregate raw score a little bit. He had a 0.79. And by the way, first of all, I want to talk about what 0.79 and 0.80 mean. A 0.80 at center is worse than a 0.79 at guard. The scales are different such that the further you get from center, the more deductions you'll normally have in pass blocking, just kind of like what you said earlier, Mike. You should be a 79 versus an 80, but an 80 is probably about equal to 82 or 83 at 82 or 83 right at center. All right. So where these adjustments came from. See, he lost 21 points in total. 0.09 was missed blocks. Not great, a little high there, but okay. Penetration's only 0.01. Remember, Linderbaum was 0.02. Pressures were 0.04, a little bit higher than Linderbaum, and also kind of expected for the positions. Quarterback hits and sacks, only 0.02. That was really good. So you'd expect him to get matched up against a three-tech if that's what other teams wanted to do from time to time. They weren't really trying to match up against Daniel Fa'alele with their great three-techs. It would be McCary that they're trying to beat. And he didn't really show up that poorly in that. But then penalties were a big one. That was 0.05. It was a hell of a lot more earlier in the season.
Yeah.
By the way. So that ended up being actually working its way back down to 0.05. He had something like 40% of his deductions at about week 10 were by penalties for the whole season. So just, you know, would have been
not sustainable.
Not sustainable. So grading McCary's play at guard only, I have him as a B for the season. And I felt a little sheepish doing that based on, you know, what had happened. But, you know, then I saw the thing from Timo, and I'm glad to see that you know, in terms of the relativity to the situation, he was better as well. He definitely does not come out that high on PFF. I will warn you that the PFF numbers for him include his tackle play, where he was substantially worse. It is one thing to kind of consider when you're looking at those.
Well, yeah, I think it is kind of encouraging that relativity score, those numbers kind of line up with that B that you get. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They really kind of reflect. They both kind of reflect that, hey, maybe when you factor in opponent situation, those kinds of things, that it was better than maybe you think.
Right. Yeah. The grade I've given him includes a subjective adjustment, which does include an attempt to factor in the opponent, not necessarily the down and distance type situations, but at least there's an attempt to figure out that he's playing against Cam Hayward in this game. He gets a higher adjustment sort of thing. Let's move on to one of the most polarizing players on the entire team, Daniel Fa'alele. What I like to say about it is the ultimate triumph of function over form. Actually grades out pretty well, particularly his last five games of the season, but he does not look or move like a guard at all, even now.
Yeah, I'll start with the disclaimer that I'm biased in favor of Fa'alele, have been since he came out of Minnesota. So, you know, it's been tough, particularly earlier in the season. It got less tough as the season went on, but particularly early in the season, I mean, the people who I really kind of interact with and engage with on Twitter who know that about me were like, what are you crazy? What is it about this guy that you like? You know, are you watching the same games that we're watching? And I'm like, look, you know, you got to factor in, it's a position change, you know, that's huge for any of these players, but particularly what you just talked about. I mean, he is a unique individual in terms of his physical dimensions. I mean, there's just not that many guys that tall, that heavy. And this is the thing I would always tell people, this is kind of the primary attraction for me, who can move the way he moves. Now, it's relative to his physical dimensions. It's not relative to all other guards in the NFL.
Relative to 380-pound player, but by humans.
He moves pretty well for a 6'8", 380-pound human being. So that, and you can't coach that. That can't be coached. That can't be taught. But there are technique things that can be coached and can be taught. There's never a guarantee that that stuff's all going to line up and you're going to get, you know, a competent player. And I think, you know, there's obviously still improvement that can be had. But I think we saw, at least I felt like, you know, a guy who showed, hey, I can be at least replacement level in this role. Now, does that mean that if they had an opportunity to upgrade him that they wouldn't? No, because I think they do that at all positions, you know, aside from the obvious ones. But, you know, everywhere, I think if there's an opportunity to come up to upgrade, you know, a position where maybe you're like, you know what, it was okay, but could it be better? Sure, they might look to do that. But I personally felt like it was solid. It was a solid performance that gradually improved over the course of the season. Still work to be done in some areas, for sure. But I felt good about it because I was like, I kind of always felt like this was the type of improvement he could show.
Right. And playing your best ball at the end of the year is fantastic. We'll get to that in a little bit. But I want to walk back something you said earlier, because I'm going to start with, you're a very nice person. You're one of the nicest people I know, Michael. And you really, really want to say bad things about a player. And to paraphrase some of the things you said to me is, there's enough bad stuff out there about every player. There's probably five times as much bad stuff as you need to have if you look at Twitter, because people are always trying to find the source of blame to make themselves somehow feel better. In terms of Falele, I don't even think it's a case of you have to make excuses for his being his first year at guard, the change in position, the unusual body type for the position, any of that. I think it's a matter of what he can't do well as a guard is less important than what he can do well as a guard. So, yes, you can always find missed blocks for this guy who goes to level two, and between the combination of decisiveness and foot speed, is probably the worst level two blocking guard I've ever observed. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay with that, because level two blocks are just not as important as making your block and controlling your man opposite you at the line of scrimmage. He has other processing things I'm not terribly happy about, but in most ways, I think the things he really does well are the really important things for an offensive lineman, and particularly how he finished the year. I would point to that, but as by far the highest missed block rate on the entire team. And a lot of that are L2NB on my score sheet. Also, ask him to pull is usually a bad idea too. He's got some PNBs as well. So it cannot seem to, he's got some pulled tripped, PNB, pulled obstructed, but there's a lot of various types of things where it doesn't work out. The one thing I would really have a question is he going to be a good enough zone blocker? Can he use his length well enough as a zone blocker to be effective running the scheme that they're going to want to run, presumably over the next couple of years, while Derrick Henry is here?
Yeah, that is kind of the million-dollar question. I think it probably hinges on the specific type of blocks you're asking him to make in those concepts. If he's kind of that first-level combo blocker, mm-hmm, with the center or maybe even with a tackle, and he gets to stay on the down lineman, and then try to kind of reach and seal that guy or wall him off, that's still not, you know, maybe his strong suit per se. But I think there's probably a better opportunity for him to accomplish that than the climb guy, right? The guy who's coming off of that first level defender and climbing to the second level. I'm not real confident in his ability to connect on those consistently. Or, you know, if he's on the backside, not in the way that you might think about a backside cut off from a tackle who's got to go up to level two and cut off like a linebacker, mm-hmm, but then maybe somebody, again, all of this is primarily happening on level one, who's got to cut off like a backside DN or a backside.
Exactly.
Yeah. Or a backside
tackle. Backside right defensive tackle. So right. somebody who basically is creating space for the cutback lane on the backside of the block where the zone blockers are basically making sure nobody crosses their face on the front. Yeah,
exactly. Because again, his size is the big advantage, right? So if he can get into positions where I'm just not able to get through this man and he essentially creates a lane for the runner, then yeah, I think, you know, there probably can be some effectiveness for him around that. But, you know, that's a lot of specific design that you know, you're incorporating into your scheme. These guys get paid a lot of money. That's what they do in terms of coaching, you know, from a coaching standpoint. And I think you saw some of that this year when they would run some of those zone concept that they would try to get him in some of those situations. But they also didn't seem to have an issue with him kind of getting, you know, the single block, the one-on-one on the front side of even like a wide zone and asking him to get out there and try and reach a guy. So I don't know how successful that was all the time, but they seem to be at least willing to you know, have him attempt those blocks as well.
Half the battle is when he knows the guy he has to block, because processing is not his strength. So yeah. As long as he knows the guy, he's got long arms, he does a pretty good job jumping into that. When pulling, he's had a hard time. He had a couple penetrations in one game alone that I can think back to where he had to pull from right to left, and he just wasn't quick enough to get the containment player on that side picked up, and that caused problems. But another problem that's been talked about him fairly regularly is physicality and not using his arms the way it is. I mean, that's certainly my complaint about him going into this year, was that he really didn't make use of his size very effectively. These last five games, he's been a monster. It's like he's got some blood on his gums and he likes the taste of it, and he's looking to pancake people. That Buffalo field was pretty sloppy. So it was a nice one for him to push people down. He did some of it in level two. He did some of that at the line of scrimmage. And he did some of it where he doesn't even get credit for the pancake when he's initially comboing with another player. That's if he gets set up, that guy's going far to one side.
Yeah. Mentality was something that I wanted to see more consistency with from him. And I think you just illustrated it, that you started to see it over those last handful of games, because I've always made like the Shaquille O'Neal comparison. Like, I'm the biggest dude out here and I know it. And there's nobody who can do anything about it. Now, that doesn't mean that you're going to win every situation, because you're playing against, you know, the best of the best. They're going to get you sometimes too. But I think there's something to be said. And when one guy who always comes to my mind when I think about those kinds of examples, not saying he's the only guy for sure, but in terms of Ravens, is KO, Kelechi Osemele.
Yeah. Like,
not that he didn't play with technique, but he got off the bus with, I'm a bad dude. Okay. And I think that can sometimes mitigate, you know, maybe some technique that isn't, you know, necessarily the highest level all the time when you're just nasty.
And he wouldn't have been the draft steal that he was for the Ravens towards the end of that second round if he didn't have some technique issues the Ravens knew they would have had to face. I mean, he's a first round draft pick all the way in terms of his size and arm length and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was good to see that from Daniel. It was good to see that. And I'm like, yeah, let's just keep that. Let's keep with that. Let's play with that consistently in every game, you know, under control. Nobody's saying go out there and like be out of control, but, you know, let people know, let people feel you out there. Like, hey, don't think that I'm, you know, some kind of big softy. Okay. Cause you're going to find yourself on your backside.
Yeah. It's great. I mean, just putting the fear of that in any player. And already level two and level three players have no desire to run into him headlong. They all try and get around him. And the Ravens can use that to their advantage pretty effectively. But McCary can even use it. Sorry, not McCary. Fa'alele can even use it to his advantage by overcorrecting in terms of leverage where he wants to be, making it easier for the player to run around him in one direction. But it's a lot harder to run around Fa'alele than it is other players.
Yeah, and that sometimes, like you said, that creates – even bigger seams and even bigger lanes. They're trying so hard to get around him to one particular side that they create these bigger than necessary seams in the defense. So, you know, sometimes that can be, it looks like, oh, he, you know, this guy's outrunning him. He can't get to this guy. Well, let him run way over there and, you know, rely on the runners to use his vision to cut and find those seams.
One thing we talk about in the actuarial work is RHE, or recent historical experience. And you'll hear me say it other ways on this show. The most recent data is the most pertinent, is what I'd say. for Daniel to have five of his best seven games be the last five games bodes very well for 2025. I don't think it was a factor at all, or not much anyway, in his Pro Bowl alternate selection, which we have no way to look behind the curtain on. By the way, this is an interesting thing. I asked Ryan Mink, what number Pro Bowl alternate was he? And he said, sorry, we don't give out that information.
Okay, there you go. There you go.
So, you know, you do hear at the end, certain people like Ronnie Stanley got elevated to the Pro Bowl, yeah. And somebody else did too. I'm forgetting who it was this week. Cal Van Noy. That's nice when it happens. It means they were like a first or second alternate probably. But Tyrod Taylor got it, I think, as a sixth alternate one time. He was the I would love to know what this is. Or is it just a nomination process where you say, everybody's got to give me one guard in the league and I'll re-rank them as alternates after everybody gives me their one guy?
Yeah.
So it could be that Harbaugh actually made him an alternate for the Pro Bowl. But he finished the season very strong. I'm extremely happy with where it went. I have some more numbers to support that. Don't think he'll play ever again at offensive tackle unless there's some sort of emergency need we can't foresee.
Yeah, it's definitely at this point more likely to be a break in case of emergency, you know, break glass in case of emergency situation. Harbaugh seemed it was almost like the Patrick Ricard thing. Like, this is, you know, this is kind of my idea. I kind of always felt like he could be guard and would be good at guard. But I think you said Joe D probably had a bigger hand in that.
He loved him. There's just no doubt about it. And here's how you can tell he really loved him. When Joe was at camp, he wasn't at camp for that long this summer before he had his medical problems show up and eventually had to go to the hospital. And that was the end very soon after that. But he had one day where he was screaming at Fa'alele, like play after plays, you know, pulling him aside, yelling at him. You don't do that against a guy you know is going to be cut. You know, to someone you know is going to be cut. You do that against to the guy you really love, and you're frustrated the heck out with the way he's playing.
Yeah, that's the old John Thompson story. If you don't hear me getting on you, that's when you need to worry.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah. I don't see any reason to believe he won't be the right guard on a de facto basis entering next year, where it might not be as obvious for me that Voorhees has got the job that'll be handed to him. I think Fa'alele right now has a lot of rope to work with in terms of failing at this job based on these last five games of this year. It's just, I don't see him losing the job.
Yeah, it would have to be, I can't even imagine what the scenario would be, but it would take a pretty unique circumstance. You'd have essentially have the opportunity to get, like, you know, a top level guard come in here that, you know, you could actually afford and not, you know, break your cap. It would have to be some crazy situation like that.
Kevin Zeitler returning.
Even more so than that, it would have to be a guy, even, you know, maybe kind of on a different tier, either from Zeitler, which, you know, you never know when these situations come up. And I think that's what they try to do, right? They try to position themselves in terms of cap dollars, in terms of draft picks, to be ready to take advantage of opportunities. They don't know what these opportunities are going to be, but you try to put yourself in position to take advantage of them if they come. A lot of times they don't come, but if they come, you know, you try to put yourself in that position. Aside from that, yeah, I'm with you. I think, you know, he would have to do something to lose the job.
There is a divisible benefit opportunity potentially here to get him signed long term. So he goes into year four. He's on a signed contract, which is good, by the way. If he'd already played 3 years like Ardarius had, he didn't have a fourth year on his deal, then he has to be given an RFA tender. But as a fourth round pick, he signed a 4 year deal and doesn't make much over the league minimum. Actually, he does make a little bit more because he's earned some incentives that escalate his salary. Okay. But other than, I mean, he makes a reasonable salary, might be $3.5 million this year coming. They could sign him for a pretty reasonable team-friendly deal right now. But this is the time to do it, not later. And they would come under some fire for doing it, given all the third-year guys. Yeah.
Imagine the outcry. I can hear it now.
Yeah, but him and Ardarius Washington, I mean, those are the kind of players who signed, you know, Nick Boyle. Those are the kind of players who sign those kind of deals. It's not, you know, Travis Jones, unfortunately. It's probably not Isaiah Likely. Adafi Owe. He's on the fifth year option. He's basically saying, look, I'm in the driver's seat now. You're paying me $14 million this next year, whether you like it or not. Yep. You got an offer? Yeah, come to me, but you know, make it worth my while, kind of thing.
Right.
Absolutely. So Falele is still at a point where if he played poorly, he could be almost, not quite, but almost out of the NFL. Maybe one more chance, 1 year somewhere, if you were to play poorly. So sort of signing for, you know, 3 years, $16 million might seem pretty good at this point to him. And I would frankly love to see that kind of thing happen.
Yeah, similar to the first Mekari situation we were talking about, right? Different in that Mekari wasn't a starter per se at that time, but an opportunity to get ahead of, yeah, of where things were going to go with that player.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So it would make a lot of sense. In the same way, Linderbaum kind of has the Ravens over a barrel. The only thing that Linderbaum has is the injury risk for this year that he'd be playing against. Yeah. He's not really incented to make a long-term deal with the Ravens, not especially incented like Washington or Falele. Real quickly, we're running way long. It always happens when we talk things or when we talk offensive line in general. His aggregate raw score for the year was 0.75. By the way, all these guys on the interior offensive line in a very close cluster of raw scores, but it's 0.75 at guard, which is you know, maybe like 0.78 at center. Missed blocks were 0.12 of his total, almost half of the total misses right there. That should tell you something. Penetrations were 0.01. Pressures were 0.06. He did have a little problem giving up some pressures. Most of that was early in the year. Quarterback hits and sacks, 0.03. And penalties, 0.02. He is another one who finished the year with hardly any penalties down the stretch. I'll just go quickly and pick this up. But it was he had six penalties for the whole year and none after week 10. Nice. So great finish for him. As well. He had some costly ones before then.
Yeah, that's good. It's good to see that trend, right, with some of the guys, considering where they started.
Yeah. So I'm going to give him two grades here. You got a C for the year at 0.75. He's right in the middle of the C range. It's not a question of whether it would be, you know, a little bit higher, a little bit lower. But the last five games, aggregate A, did not allow a quarterback hit, did not allow a sack, did not allow a penetration, allowed two pressures in the last five games. And I have him for one penalty here. And I just saw this. Oh, it must have been in the playoff game. Must have been in one of the two playoff games that this occurred, because he didn't. I'll look for the postseason here. Nope, didn't have in the playoff game. So I'll have to figure out where that was. But I have him for one penalty in these last two games. So great finish to the year for Falele. And I'm at the peak. I'm at the apex of my Falele excitement right now. Are you? You're a pro Falele guy to start with. I can't imagine you're not more of a pro Falele guy now.
Oh yeah, I'm not at the apex. I think we can go higher. I think the excitement level can go even higher.
Yeah, and I just mean to the sense that, you know, the stock market's at 6,100 or 6,000 or whatever it is today. It's a local high, but I wouldn't be invested in it if I didn't think it could go higher, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, it could be the prime opportunity to sell. I don't know how this is going to go, but I'm pretty excited with where he is, because it's what I thought he was capable of.
Yeah.
And I think he can continue to even could get a little bit better.
All right, let's move on and talk about Andrew Voorhees. We thought he'd be one of the real players who got a chance to play this year. They did kind of force him into the starting lineup after what was not a great preseason. And a red shirt season, obviously, in 23, where he's NFI for the entire year. But we didn't really see him able to convert that bench press strength into on-field results in his first season of actual NFL play.
Yeah, and there's a difference. There's a difference between weight room strength and a difference between on-field functional strength. Sometimes they align. Sometimes those two things align because guys understand how to take one and translate it to the field. As a guy in his first year coming off of essentially a redshirt year, recovering from an injury, you may have still been figuring that out, how to take that weight room strength and how to functionally translate it onto the field. And, you know, unfortunately didn't get a longer runway to work through that, but did get an opportunity earlier, and that's better than no opportunity at all.
Yeah, it's still a year one opportunity. So there's a lot of sand in the hourglass left on Voorhees. I'm still excited about where he might develop. Lean player, not the typical gourd shape or the pear shape you want in a guard. You know, you want to have a lower body, heavy, lots of muscle, big glutes and thighs and whatnot. And that's really not him. He's more of a vertical athlete, kind of like John Simpson was. in terms of not being as big down there. And he's going to struggle probably with that body type. And in fact, you see him and you think maybe even he belongs at tackle. It would not shock me if Voorhees were to play some offensive tackle at some point for the Ravens. It would shock me more if Falele went back there.
Yeah, and it might turn out, depending on how much they lean into it. I mean, look, they're never going to completely go away from gap scheme concepts with pullers. They're always going to have some of that mixed in there. But depending on how heavily they lean into zone, and particularly if they lean like super heavy into wide zone, more than inside zone, tight zone, where that's more about vertical double teams, his skill set might be a better fit in terms of, you know, getting on the move, getting on those train tracks, trying to get defenders to move horizontally. That body type might actually be a better, you know, you think back to like the Kubiak season, yeah, right? Where you're running like a lot of wide, a lot of stretch wide zone, and you need more John Urschel body type, you know what I mean? Yeah. That kind of thing. Might actually be a better fit from a skill set perspective.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to see if they decide to do it. When you look at his pass blocking for the year, it was actually pretty good. He's right in the middle of all the PFF guys with 20% plus of snaps, 40 out of 83. But what really stood out is a very poor penalty rate. He had 4 penalties and 250 snaps. Obviously, that's not a big sample size in which to work, but it's also 1,526 millisimpsons. So John Simpson is 1,000. His rate is 1,000. He's 1.526 times as high in terms of penalty rate than John Simpson was for his career or for last year. So that's too high for a guard, and hopefully he'll be able to correct that. And given, you know, Warhop's success in getting the other guys straightened out down the stretch, I think it's possible.
Yeah, you got to think so, just based on those results that you just talked about with McCary and Falele. Oh, and, you know, being a first-year player, you know, there's you know, DaCosta talked about this, right, about moving on from Zeitler, and I'm blanking on the other tackles
Simpson.
Now. Moses,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they knew that they were going to move away from some vets and move to some younger players, and that they were going to take some lumps. You know, I think that was the exact phrase. It's like they're going to take some lumps in terms of the growing pains with those younger players, you know, on the field. So you'd like fewer lumps than that. But, you know, that's part of the process sometimes with younger, inexperienced players.
Yeah. What else? He came back and he played after McCary had that stomach virus. I had it too. It's nasty stuff. So he tried to play, played 6 snaps in week 18. Came out of the game, and then Voorhees went in and played very well against Cleveland. And I would have given that more weight, importance, whatever you want to call it, but Cleveland's missed tackle effort in that last season was completely attributable to them giving up basically on the season, having no interest in finishing that season.
Yeah, and they had a bunch of guys out. I mean, I know Miles Garrett and some other guys played, but in their interior guy, they had at least 2 or 3 guys, I think, who had been contributors on the interior D-line for them during the year who didn't play in that game. And so, look, I get it. It's the NFL. So you line up and you block whoever is out there. But as somebody who scores this and you talk about it before, you make adjustments for opponent. It's a factor, you know.
Aggregate raw score of 0.77. So if, again, these guys are in a tight cluster. The big difference for him, and I won't go through all these in his pass blocking numbers are pretty good. His penalty number is minus 0.07. So that was where he lost a lot of points. You know, that's unfortunate, but in a sense, it might be fortunate because it's correctable. I think it's a C first year in the NFL, what he did. It's certain that's how it would work out in terms of his raw score. I look anytime a first-year player gets a C, very favorable. Linderbaum was like a C-plus his first year. You know, all kinds of projection could be thrown on top of that, all positive projection. Osemele was like that, and they moved him to guard in the playoffs, and he was outstanding. Whenever I see that in out of a first-year offensive lineman, I'm very excited.
That's very encouraging to hear because I think there were a lot of high hopes coming into this season because of the need that they had at both guard positions about, you know, what he would look like and what he might be able to do. But you got to feel even better maybe going into next season about, you know, kind of that next step that maybe he can take.
We talked a little bit about Ben Cleveland earlier. We really would love to know what's wrong. was not part of the left guard or right guard camp battle at any time. When he did get an opportunity, it was to play center as a backup when Linderbaum had that neck problem that was leaving him out for a while. Got to play some in the games, got to play a little bit in mop-up duty during the regular season every, but then he ended up only playing 48 total snaps. Most of that was as a sixth offensive lineman. Just a very disappointing finish to his Ravens career. I don't anticipate he'll be back, but I guess you never know, but I don't see a path to it.
No, it looks like the writing's on the wall that he's probably gone. And he, you know, from his side, he may want to be gone so that he can get, you know, an opportunity somewhere else. Was it this preseason or last preseason where they even had him like playing some tackle?
That might have been last preseason. Yeah. He did play some tackle. And, you know, I thought that from the start of his career, given his length and his size and whatnot, that he might be a guy who could be a tackle. And that was, remember, when the Ravens had all those problems in 21 in particular. Yeah. That might have been, the time that you might have to use Ben Cleveland at tackle. But it never ended up materializing.
No, that was kind of another sign to me. That's the only reason I bring that up, because I'm like, all right, they're trying this guy all over the place. There's something going on here.
Well, let's talk about the offseason ahead and some of the needs for these for what the Ravens need to do here. I think, as I see it, they've got two key decisions. The first is how, when they extend Tyler Linderbaum. But I think it's my mind, it's now or never.
Yeah, like you said, before May, right? Preferably if you can make that happen. But it's going to be interesting because you made the point that he's kind of holding the leverage card. So it'll be interesting to see if they can get that done.
They've got a little more leverage with him because he's playing a year at like $5 million. Oway is the guy who really holds all the cards against the Ravens because he's got a fifth-year option. He's already going to be playing. So anyway, they'll probably have to figure it out. He's one of several that they, you know, Travis Jones is critically important to this team right now in terms of where they go. And Isaiah Likely, I mean, he's the key to moving on from Mark Andrews if that's really what you want to do.
Absolutely.
So you got to get him signed long-term. So, you know, it's so many players, and I'd hate to see them let Linderbaum walk, particularly would really all the walks they've had just should kill your depth. The 2024 Ravens got by, you know, with this great continuity they had on the team, but should have killed their depth to lose all the players they did.
Yeah, and he's the guy, he's the type of guy that DeCosta has talked about. Like, hey, when we draft young players and they develop and turn into good core players for us, we want to retain those guys. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know that they'll do, certainly going to be a best effort kind of situation. I don't think they're going to like play any like games trying to, you know, low ball or anything like that. I don't know that they do that anyway with the guys that, you know, they really feel strongly about, but I think they'll get something done. I feel good about it. I think they'll get something done.
Yeah, I do too. Okay. Let's talk about decision number two, which is, do you try and extend McCary? Do you commit completely to Voorhees with a relatively thin backup group, and look for, that would, I'm sure, mean, and it would mean anyway, looking to the draft for a left guard?
Yeah, I like the approach we talked about earlier where McCary is probably going to price himself out, but you make him an offer. You let him go test the market. If he finds something out there better he likes, you wish him, you know, best wishes, you know, and hope, you know, he has a great career. But that's probably the approach for me at this point is you try to retain him, you make that offer, but you understand kind of where you are financially. And then, you know, that you have Voorhees, you know, who's shown some potential. And you talked about that grade that he had for the year and how that's always an encouraging sign for you. So cupboard's not totally bare. If McCary was to leave, you'd love to retain him, but I feel like you have at least, I don't even want to necessarily call it a succession plan, a succession idea, a succession vision of how this could work out. So,
that's where it is, because all has to be kind of decided before the draft.
Yeah,
someone is going to sign Stanley before the draft, whether it's the Ravens or somebody else. But we could certainly be looking at an Armageddon type situation where Stanley, Jones, McCary, and Cleveland are all gone. And that is a incredible component of your depth. That's actually four of your eight active game day linemen leaving the team.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we thought they had a lot to overcome after 2023.
Yeah.
This would be
worse.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think there's a high probability of guard being drafted no matter what. you know, we just talked about the gutting, so we don't need to talk about this. I also think if Josh Jones is re-signed, from what I've seen, I want him playing sixth offensive lineman, offensive tackle as a backup, or maybe even offensive tackle as a starter for a year. But I think he's too valuable to have on the field a lot on the interior because of his OT value. I wouldn't use him like the way the Ravens used McCary this last year.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Nice contingency to have, you know, being able to get him and still relatively young guy. Right? I don't think he's 30 years old yet, is he? I don't think.
No, he's been in the league for 6 years now, I think. So I'll look it up while you're
late 20s, probably somewhere in there, 20, 27, 28, he 29. Might
be 27, yep.
Yeah, somewhere in there. And we talk all the time, right, about how valuable offensive tackle depth is in the league. So, you know, having that in-house is kind of a nice contingency to have.
Yeah. Potentially three of their four offensive tackles are walking after the season with Rosengarten being the only one they keep, and then you might have Rosengarten switching positions. So this could be a very tough year for Lamar Jackson if that goes down that way. Michael, always a complete pleasure talking football with you. Thank you for making the time to have this discussion tonight. Always great when you can do that. Tell folks where they can talk football with you online.
Still out there on Twitter at Abukari, Abukari. Also on Blue Sky under the same name, Abukari. I mean, I know a lot of people some people migrated over there like completely. Probably more people like me, probably, you know, keeping accounts on both platforms. So can find me over there too. Still haven't kind of posted as much over there. It's just you know, there's another thing you got to remember to do. Like, oh yeah, I got to make sure I put this over there too. Haven't really been doing the podcast with Deep Cover and Fire Zone. Kind of really took a break from doing those. So I won't necessarily say go look for those, because if you do, it's probably something from like last year. But you know, who knows what the future holds, whether we get those kickstarted up again or not. But yeah, pretty much Twitter and Blue Sky, where you can find me. Doing a lot of draft prospect watching over the last 2 months. Mostly senior and Shrine Bowl guys trying to get through those rosters in the trenches, primarily looking at offensive and defensive line. So just trying to get
who's a guard that might be available at pick 30 or so.
Oh, in the first round, the Senior Bowl or the Shrine Bowl, you could have a couple guys that I've liked, and this is why I hesitated, because I'm not real good at the round projection stuff. And I'm pretty sure that some of these names I'm about to say are guys who probably would not be first rounders. So I'm not necessarily.
I'm sorry to put you on the spot. We'll have you back in the draft. And
No, I've got some names, but they're just probably not guys who would be first round guys. Like whether it's Joe Huber from Wisconsin or Jack Conley from Boston College. You know, Luke Newman from Michigan State. There's a number of guys that I like, but they're probably more, day three type guys, to be honest. Some of them might get into day two, but those are probably more. I find that I gravitate more toward those mid to late round picks in my prospect watching. And I think I'm probably the opposite of most people. I think most people, if they are into this and they start to kind of do their own watching on these guys, they tend to start with first round guys. I don't. I tend to start with the mid to late round guys and then circle back around to the first round guys later in the process.
That makes you an exceptional resource, because, you know, the depth is the hard thing. In particular, you know, my process is to make top 10 lists, and, you know, I'm cultivating that down from maybe 20 guys, but I never really get below about guy number 20 or 22 in the draft in terms of looking at them. And that's looking at some consensus picks and whatnot. So makes you very valuable. I always have loved the draft show. And hopefully we can work it out so that you can do it one of the positions again this year, Mike.
Yeah, you got to get to your Nash Jones at Texas State or your Marcus Weir at Montana State.
There you go. There you go. Other folks out there, I hope you'll join us for the draft coverage again this year. It's something that we really enjoyed doing last year. And we had a big board that we were kind of filling out with active participants on the fly. That was a lot of fun. The video should be out there, but effectively we're sharing a spreadsheet at the same time, and we're kind of selecting the names of people we think might be good for the Ravens when they next got up. We definitely went 0-for-4, I think, on the Ravens' last four guys, because, you know, nobody had Sanusi Kane or Devin Leary or Nick Samak
I could see that
on their bingo card there. But it's a lot of fun to watch the draft with other people like that. And it just, I can't thank the people who listen to this show enough for the quality of their engagement with it. So thank you very much. Michael, thank you again for coming on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Ken. Enjoyed it.
Talk to you next time on Film Study.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us, for open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.